Let's look at that 40-year period. And 1962 being a key year in the modern consciousness movement. And Esalen is one of the stories you tell in the book. And just reading that, we see you writing the history, which is what Allen Ginsberg and Ed Sanders say that poets should do. And you yourself, I know that you write poetry, Sherry. I don't know if Paul does or not, but poets should be writing the history, and you are writing the history. So we're going to look back at this in 100 years and realize what you're saying is incredibly true and incredibly important. And in 1962, they thought they were just some drug-taking weirdos on the coast doing weird things. But Esalen is going to have a lot more significance when it comes down to history, isn't it?
Yes, and you know, one of the interesting things that maybe those of us who were around in those early days, we thought if you're sitting Zen, then you're not out protesting the war. If you're changing the laws that apply to women, you're not doing the deep inner psychological reflective work. And I think that was true in the beginning. It was very hard to do whatever you were doing, you were focusing on. But there's a big change now. And the change is, for one thing, the constituency of all those movements were basically and are basically the cultural creatives. So the values and the worldview are coming together in a great current of change. And what we find now is that people who care deeply about spiritual development and inner growth are also the same people who are deeply committed to what's happening around the world, who care about the planet, and who are committed to social justice, so that we're seeing a common thread unfold. Thread isn't even the right word. It's a current of change. It's like a Gulf Stream. It's changing the climate of our times.
Yeah, and when we look at that, many of the people of the 60s were only interested in themselves. And so you had them, you know, doing their Zen or whatever and not be interested, only be interested in their own selves. And likewise today, even to this day, we have people who are activists who have no interest in the inner self, no interest whatsoever. And we could be talking about moderns with a leftist bent quite often.
Yeah, that's right. There are a lot of people who think of themselves as movement people who are still well within a more materialistic, power-oriented kind of culture. It's very crucial to cultural creatives that they were more if affected by the cultural arms of the movements, who were reframing, who were changing the meaning of things, who were going deeper into values questions, so that the tendency to say everything about the movements is political isn't really the cultural creative's view. The tendency to say that is really to relate all social movements to current modern politics, the kind of politics that's really concerned with shuffling the politicians around. Choose one from column A or column B, and that's all the choices you've got. The cultural creative's pattern is to go after a much deeper, richer variety of meanings than that.
An integration of the proactive activist movement and the consciousness movement. I think that's what we're getting. We're getting integration here throughout the work, which is very gratifying for someone who's trying to integrate arts and social services through the Spoken Word Lab and so on and so forth. The term New Age is often given to people that you're talking about. And no grimaces, so that's a good sign, but New Age doesn't quite cover it, does it?
New Age, in fact, the most expanded perspective of what the New Age is about 5% of the population. Now, we're talking with the cultural creatives about 26%. And then when you see that about half of that 5% that we're calling New Age are moderns, not cultural creatives, you only have maybe 2-3% of cultural creatives could be considered New Age. It's like a little tiny postage stamp hanging off the envelope that we're describing. But here's an interesting thought. If you think about, well, who are these people that are called New Age? You know, one way to think about it is these are the people who are new at spirituality or inner development. They're learning. They're new to the game. They want to buy stuff that reflects what these new values are.
Spiritual materialism is a word you use in the book.
Well, spiritual materialism is a way to describe people who are trying hard to hold on to some matter, some material form of what spirituality is. So it might look like crystals or
A dream catcher,
or a certain kind of earrings, or a certain kind of clothes. But really, what's been happening over the last 40 years in the consciousness movement is a very powerful thing. First, you have some direct experience of what's sacred or what's deeply meaningful. And then what you need to do is you need tools to develop the consciousness so that that kind of experience isn't just a one-time thing, but becomes part of your life. You stabilize that kind of consciousness. That takes time. It takes discipline and practice and dedication. In addition to the direct experience and to those tools and discipline, you need a sangha, you need a community. You need someone who can also mirror your values. And when you put those all together, what you have is a deeply meaningful, grounded life, and it takes 10, 15, 20 years for that to develop. Now, if you think of the new age or people who might be described as new age as the beginners on that path, and then you see that what's been happening for cultural creatives is a deepening over time of that. You see something that's kind of like a tree with rings around it. And the heartwood of the tree is growing. The people who have more and more experience in inner development, spirituality, wellness. And on the outer rim of the tree, the newest part, you see what's called the New Age.
Yeah, they describe my show as, is your show New Age? And I said, no, I think the New Age is about taking the I Ching and making it go cha-ching, you know. So, and it's about selling, you know, it's really a modern kind of thing. A couple of devil's advocate questions. First of all, here you are labeling a whole subculture of Americans. Now, labeling is about pigeonholing, it's about controlling, and it's about eventually selling people stuff. So is there a fear about labeling these people that they'll become another source for direct marketers, which they already are, I guess?
All right. Well, that's a very good question to ask, because everybody hates to be labeled, let's face it. And we've certainly heard a lot of stick-on labels over the years, the yuppies, the boomers, and the bobos who are in paradise and all that kind of stuff. And each of those stick-on labels is arbitrary in some sense, and it's very thin. It doesn't tell you very much about how people actually live. But, you know, saying that cultural creatives is a label is like saying being French or German is a label, because real culture is very rich, very complex, and has a lot of variety to it. So we're not cutting down anybody's options by noting that they're cultural creatives and have a lot in common with each other. In fact, quite the contrary, we think we need the term so that cultural creatives can start having a word for people who are like themselves and recognize each other. Because, of course, one thing we've left out in our discussion all this time is that cultural creatives scarcely know that each other are there. They're kind of like an audience, all facing in the same direction, coming to the same conclusions, reading the same stuff, liking this and disliking the same things, but they don't turn and talk to each other. So they don't really have a good sense of themselves or what's going on. When I do focus groups, sometimes we'll tell people, well, you are in this room because you share values of the following kind with everybody. And somebody will invariably say, oh, I don't know how you got so many of us in a room. I know it's just me and a couple of my friends, 50 million of them. And they think it's just me. So the weird feeling you get about this is, how is it possible for 50 million people not to know they're there? And of course, there's two big answers. One big answer is the media says you're not there. To Time Magazine, it would be offensive if you had 50 million people who share these values, because it would mean that they don't necessarily see the world exactly as it is, that their view of the world is just another arbitrary picture. So they don't want it to be true. But it's also the case that The media is never going to offer a fair mirror to cultural creatives because what they're doing is, in fact, supporting the dominant culture. Their job is to say things are right the way they are, it supports our advertisers, and like that. But in addition, we have a second big reason cultural creatives don't know they're there. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Before I go to that, I want to mention cultural creatives take in a lot more information than most Americans. So if you take in a lot of information that's all biased, you're going to come to a logical conclusion that it's just you and a couple of your friends. The flip side of it is we don't talk about values at work or in public politics, for that matter, unless our values happen to be those of the religious right. And everybody looks at the religious right as really rude, crude people who are doing something that kind of stinks.
Who exaggerate their numbers,
oh yes. So the big thing here with cultural creatives is they're caught. I have had the experience of consulting with a lot of companies where, at a guess, about a third of the executives are cultural creatives. And I'll talk about the cultural creatives as their market. I'll talk about it as what happens inside the companies. And a number of times, several different executives have come up and said to me, "Shh, I'm going to tell you something. I don't want you to tell anybody else. I really totally agree with those values. That's where I live. But nobody else here in this entire organization shares any of this with me. And it's really terrible to be here." And I said, "Well, how do you know?" And the answer is, of course, "Well, nobody talks about values like this. That's how I know." "Well, when was the last time you talked about values like this?" And of course, what it is, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. We have an unspoken culture of public life and business life which says you don't talk about values. Well, then, if you've got values that are different than the ones that are supposed to be there, the getting and spending and making a buck and getting status, if your values are different, then by God, you have a real fear that somebody's going to ruin your career if you speak up or put you down, that something really precious to you will be scorned.
So by default, the values are the coffee that you come in drinking, and the values are Herbert Marcuse's values of the one-dimensional man, whatever the media fills in to the blank if it's there, or you assume that if your values differ, but everybody else's seem to be reflected in the media. And boy, we have so many questions. We're out of time for this segment of the interview. Doctors Paul Ray and Sherry Ruth Anderson are the authors of The Cultural Creatives, How 50 Million People Are Changing the World. Find them on the web at culturalcreatives.org or look on our website for a link at inpeoria.org. That's inpeoria.org.